5 weeks ago. We had a lesson that we began on the providence of God. After that lesson, I don't know if it's the next week or the 2 weeks after that, Ward gave me a paper that's called Reason and Revelation. It just happened that there's an article in this paper called The Providence, or God's Providence and the Problem of Evil. About a 6-page article. It's a very good article because he agrees with everything I said. It's specifically God's providence in relation to the problem of evil. Does God cause evil? Is he a good God or whatever? If you'd like a copy of it, I can make copies for you. On the fourth page of your family news, we have part of the outline that we'll be looking at today. But I wanted to make a comment, and it's something that we could spend much more time on, and that's the difference in miracles and providence. A miracle, and here's words we need to probably define. A miracle is something that is beyond the natural. But what do we mean by natural? When Jesus, the apostles, all the way back in the Old Testament, when Elijah or Elisha raised someone from the dead or cured their leprosy or whatever, a miracle is beyond the natural way of getting cured, shall we say. When Jesus healed the blind man, the crippled man, as Peter did at the crippled man in Acts the 3rd chapter. It was beyond natural means of curing the blind or the lame or whatever. In Acts the 2nd chapter, verse 22, in Peter's lesson or sermon or speech there in the day of Pentecost after the resurrection of Jesus, he mentions that this is a man talking about Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God by many mighty works, wonders, and signs. In other words, the signs, the miracles that Jesus performed when he was here on earth were not just to heal the blind man or to raise the dead, but it was for the purpose of showing that he was from God, that the things he was doing in those miracles are beyond the power of just mere men. Providence, on the other hand, does not necessarily include miracles. In fact, I guess that would be one way to distinguish. That doesn't mean that sometimes when God's providence was working that there weren't some miracles, but that's getting into more than I want to talk about right now. In Isaiah, the 65th chapter, verse 9, God provides the rain. Every time it rains, it's not a miracle. Now, God did indeed, when he created the heavens and the earth and put the things into motion, that the earth does evaporate the seas, the ocean, the evaporation goes up into the sky and comes down in rain over the land. That creation that God created was a miracle. But it raining the other day was not a miracle. It was following, quote, the natural processes that God put into effect. In Acts the 23rd chapter, to illustrate further, in the 23rd chapter of Acts, there was, I guess you could say, a miracle. God told Paul that he was going to testify in Rome. That speaking to him was not a natural thing for just ordinary men. But how did Paul go from Jerusalem, Caesarea, and then finally to Rome? The way that God got Paul to Rome was not a miracle. But Paul's nephew found out when Paul was in Jerusalem still, if I recall the incident, Paul's nephew found out that there was a plot laid by some of the Jews to, was it 40 men that made this plot to kill Paul? Paul's nephew went to the proper people to let the centurion know about the plot. That was not a miracle. But it worked out that Paul was conveyed out of Jerusalem to Caesarea by the soldiers, and the plot to kill Paul was thwarted. Eventually, Paul spent some time in Caesarea and then eventually went to Rome. So Paul, God told Paul, you're going to testify of me in Rome. But he did not work a miracle in that instance to get him from Jerusalem to Caesarea and finally to Rome. That was providential. And I hope that that may be helpful in understanding a little bit about providence. We said that I don't understand everything in God's providential care or workings. But I think we can understand enough that hopefully we can have appreciation for what God does provide for us because of his foresight, yes. Much more could be added to what we said in our last lesson and in our lesson today, which will be the second part of our lessons. And we'll try to finish this study today. Good to see you. Glad you're here. We have some visitors. We've got two special visitors over here so far as the Givens are concerned. My niece and her husband, Corinne and Dan. When you were here last time, was I speaking? Did Brian spoke? I thought, well, man, seemed like that every time they visit, I'm speaking. And I thought, well, don't come on the first Sunday of the month or you'll hear me. So be forewarned. Good to have you. Some are gone. We appreciate you being here because some are gone. What we want to do today is to preview, just hopefully not too long of a time, the providence of God. We said that in that first lesson we would look at two questions, and that's the first two questions here that we looked at. What is the meaning of providence, and what are the characteristics of God's providence, and what is its purpose? Those were the 2 points, and we're going to review those. And then the third point is, in what ways can God's providence be understood in this present day? And that third point is what we're going to look at today. But we had the meaning of the word providence from a dictionary is to care, the care, or benevolent guidance of God. Okay, well, the word provide, from the Latin providere, is that the way you say it? Means etymologically to foresee. In God's ability, he can foresee the future. And this is where it gets difficult in our minds. If God can foresee something in the future, and yet he does not cause a person to act contrary to their own free will, but having the ability to foresee the future, he can provide, he can arrange the development or the working out of his plan. There it says the corresponding Greek word, pronoia, means forethought. So in providence, in the word providence, there is the idea of forethought for the bringing about the provision that God has. So far as the characteristics and purpose of divine providence, we studied in that first lesson that providence does not order every single act or event. God does not say for every act and event that happens, he's ordering it. He does some, he uses some acts and events, but in God's providence, every single act of every single person, every event, and every time is not ordered by God. And that, again, is where sometimes it makes providence difficult if he doesn't order every single act or event, how is it that it is his providence that brings about certain things? Well, that's what we try to understand. But the second point in that lesson was providence does not eliminate human suffering. And that's what this article was mainly about, God's providence and the problem of evil, suffering. In other words, there is suffering in the world. Why doesn't God providentially eliminate that human suffering? That's not what his purpose is in this world. And let me say more about that. Providence does not have material but spiritual good as the end. Now, did God's providence provide for the rain? Yes. But the end of his providence, in fact, the end of all of God's eternal purpose was for spiritual good. And so not saying that by God's providence we have rain and sunshine and so forth. I just thought events. I heard yesterday or read yesterday, maybe you saw it also. A lot of us are on Facebook. And I think that's where I saw it, is that the earth, 70% of the earth, and I'm not sure these are the right figures, but 70%, three quarters I've heard, of the earth is covered in water. And 60% of it is in Texas right now. Did God cause that flooding in Texas where people are swept away and their automobiles, their houses are flooded? No. He doesn't cause every single event or action. But his providence is for a spiritual end, even though sometimes there are material benefits from what he has placed in order. The fourth one is providence is not only for the sake of the chosen, but for the many. And we've already kind of illustrated that. I'm talking about the chosen one of God, even in the Old Testament as well as right now. God's people are followers of Christ. They're Christians. They're disciples of Christ. And he provides for us. But those who are not chosen are also benefit of God's providence. And the illustration is the farmer receives rain. He grows his crops. God put that into effect, like in the beginning, as we've already illustrated. So in God's love, kindness, grace, there are certain things that people who are not of his people will receive benefit from. But, as we said, the whole end of his providence is spiritual in nature. Now, the providence of God throughout the ages. Let me just use two illustrations. The wicked Assyrians, got to get your Old Testament history in mind here, were used as God's instrument to bring about the destruction upon the idolatrous northern kingdom of Israel. We're talking about that period of time when the Israelites had divided into the north and the south. And Isaiah puts it perfectly to talk about that time when God brings another nation or another people against his own people, his chosen. Isaiah, the 10th chapter. Verses 5 through 19 particularly. But if you're over there, fine. If not, here's what verse 5 through 7 says of Isaiah 10, illustrating or actually saying how God used some wicked Assyrian kings and people to bring destruction upon the idolatrous northern kingdom. Isaiah 10, verse 5. Ah, Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in their hands is my fury. This is God speaking. Isaiah is recording what God said. Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in their hands is my fury. Against a godless nation I send him. The godless nation is northern Israel. against the people of my wrath, I command him to take spoil and seize plunder and to tread them down like the mire of the street. But he does not so intend. That is the Assyrian kings and his army. He does not so intend, and his heart does not so think. What? That I'm using him. But in his heart, it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. So God used wicked Assyrians, and he used them because that was in their heart to do that. But the Assyrians did not know that they were being used by God. When the Assyrian crisis was at its height, many of Isaiah's countrymen were whispering that the Assyrian gods are more powerful than Yahweh, the God of Israel. That's what those northern Israelites thought. It's their God is more powerful than our God. Everyone saw nothing more in the Assyrians than a greed for conquest. Even the Assyrians thought they were following no higher master than their own sovereign will. Second Kings this time, the 18th chapter. But observe from a higher perspective, God's, the Assyrians were subject to God's will and serving God's purposes. Did God make the Assyrians do what they did without their will? No. It was their will to be wicked like that, and God was able to use them, and that's providential, and that's a whole lot of what I don't understand, how God can do that except by foresight and yet not force them to do it. Your Old Testament, you remember Nebuchadnezzar. Destroyed Jerusalem and took the chosen people captive. Now this is the southern kingdom. Israel's gone. 722, the Assyrians took them into captivity. But now Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, comes. And to the contemporary Hebrew, or to the Jews of that day, when Nebuchadnezzar came and besieged the city three times, and finally the third time destroyed it, it looked like the end of all things for them. That is the Jews. But out of this fiery furnace came a refined and purified remnant. The people were taken away from Jerusalem, Judea, over into Babylonian captivity. Before they came back, they had been purified, as it were, refined, this remnant, dedicated to the one true God of heaven. And in Daniel, the fourth chapter and the fifth chapter, Daniel says, the power of Nebuchadnezzar to do that was of God. But Nebuchadnezzar was doing it of his own free will because that's the kind of fellow the Babylonians were. So it gets kind of, well, how is it? Well, that's about probably the best I can tell you, is that God, in his foresight, is able to use these wicked nations because they're willing to do that, even though they don't know that they're God's instrument to do it. I hadn't planned to use this, but one that I always think of, probably before those two, but those are powerful ones, I think, is Pharaoh of Egypt. When God sent Moses back to Egypt to lead the people out of bondage, in one passage it says God hardened Pharaoh's heart. But did God harden Pharaoh's heart without his will, against his will, with no ability to do otherwise? No, God doesn't do that. But when God sent Moses and God said, let his people go through Moses, Pharaoh was of mind, he's not going to do it. He hardened his heart against it. 10 plagues, miracles were performed, but Pharaoh said no. Did God make Pharaoh say no against his will? No, he was that type of fellow. And yet in God's providence and God's ability to use wicked kings of Assyria and Babylon, when God said, do this, Pharaoh hardened his heart against that because that's what he was. And it worked out to God's purposes. Finally, the last plague, if you call it that, the killing of the firstborn, and Pharaoh told Moses, go. But he still, when they had left, chased after them, didn't he? Well, if we love God and live according to his purpose, both the bitter and the sweet of our lives will be woven by the hand of God, and somebody says, to use a phrase in Revelation, into the beautiful robes of white. Let me repeat that. If we love God and live according to his will, both the bitter and the sweet in our lives will be woven by the hand of God into the beautiful robes of white, to use the phrase in Revelation. Many adversaries may serve to develop us for more useful service. Let me use the New Testament example of what Peter talks about, 1 Peter, the first chapter. Now, Peter is talking to some people there that are going to undergo terrible persecution, and he's trying to encourage them, remain faithful. Their adversaries were the Romans. So Peter told those people, facing this terrible event in their lives, 1 Peter, the first chapter, verse 6 and 7. In this you rejoice, though for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Those people were going to be tested. But Peter told them, you rejoice, because this, if your faith is tested and you come out, you'll be found under the praise and glory and honor of Jesus Christ. So what I'm saying here is poverty, persecution, affliction, and many other things may develop within us qualities that make us more like Christ. Anything that makes us more useful servant in the Master's vineyard is for good. It's worth everything that it may cost, regardless of the price and money, or toil, or pain, or sacrifice. God, in his providence, may not take away from us the pain and the suffering, the persecution, or whatever it might be, like those people Peter was speaking to, may not take away from us those things. But God says, if your faith is tested like gold in the fire and you come through, that makes you a better servant of mine. So sometimes God overrules evil to work spiritual good, and he did that with the people in the Old Testament, with the people, the remnant that came out of Babylon. He overruled the evil work to the spiritual good of those people. They came back and did not worship idols again. God's providence accomplishes great ends out of promising beginning. And we've kind of already illustrated this. For instance, in the human point of view, the crucifixion of Jesus marked the end of Jesus Christ. I said from the human point of view. When Jesus was crucified, his enemies thought, well, now we can breathe more easily. The enemies of Christ, those who stood out there and said, crucify him, crucify him. He was crucified. Wow, we got rid of that guy. His followers, when Jesus was crucified, were plunged into despair. But now we know that it is apparent that the cross accomplished the greatest possible good for all of mankind. So we say the providence of God throughout the ages, particularly as we're looking at the New Testament forward, accomplished great ends out of unpromising beginnings. Who in the days of the Roman Empire would have thought that the church, with all the destruction, persecution that was brought upon it in the first century, and there was a lot of persecution of Christians in the first century, both by Jews and by Rome, who would have thought it would still be in existence and growing after the powers of her enemies have subsided? Those who were preaching the kingdom in the first century were men of humble means, humble education. Paul says that in 1 Corinthians, the first chapter, verse 26. To them was given the magnificent task of preaching the word. But God, so to speak, was the equalizer. He told them not to fear. We cannot always accurately measure the present with our feeble understanding. In other words, when we're in the present situation that we may find ourselves, and probably those Christians back there were the same way, when they were persecuted, when they were scattered, when they were killed, when they were put to death at the stake, when they were put in the arena and the lions came, they couldn't actually understand, maybe. Many of them were faithful, some were not. But the apparent failures, or seeming failures, can sometimes result in immeasurable good. But what I'm saying is, put with us today now, we cannot always accurately measure the present. Is this God's providence that's working? Right now, I'd say I cannot tell where it is or not. I look back and I say, well, yeah, I think he was working providentially back there. Our work may be compared to the ripples of water. You ever thrown a pebble into a pond? And it plops out there and the ripples go out, doesn't it? Far beyond the point where the ripple, the stone went into the water. That may be the way that our lives are, that right now, that at the very moment, whatever's happened to us, we may not understand. It may be that there's the stone thrown into the water, but the rippling effects, if we're faithful to God, eventually we can look back, well, that worked out to good. Providence of God accomplishes great things out of it. Great ends out of unpromising beginnings. God uses men of faith as instruments for spiritual enlightenment through his providence. Now, in the New Testament, sometimes he would use a miracle to you go there. A miracle in the sense that when Saul went to Damascus and stayed there blind for 3 days, God sent by his speaking to Ananias. Same thing back over there in Acts, the 8th chapter, I think, when Philip was told to go down from the way that goes from Gaza there was an angel that spoke to Philip. Okay, I'd call that a miracle. That was inspiration by God. But when Philip got down there, Philip did the speaking.